Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Friday, February 12th, 2016. And no matter what Jed Clampett says, we need to keep it in the ground.
I've been listening to my story about a man named Jed. Poor mountaineer barely kept his family fed. And then one day he was shooting at some food, and up through the ground come a bubbling crew. All that is black gold, Texas tea.
Yeah, that's a theme from the Beverly Hillbillies by Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs, real icons of the banjo picking world. And before we get into our top story today, I want to alert all listeners that this Sunday is Valentine's Day, and you can take care of your love business. But in between, I want to invite you to join us for an important telethon. We're going to be launching NewsBud, the independent, publicly funded news platform that we plan to launch later this year. And we're going to launch the funding campaign, a Kickstarter campaign, with a Google Hangout telethon on Sunday. And don't worry if Google Hangout isn't in your tech universe. Don't worry about that. You'll be able to access it very easily. Just go to boilingfrogspost.com. And on the homepage will be a link to the live video feed. We're going to do two feeds, one starting at 11 a.m. Pacific time, and I'll leave the time shift calculations to you on depending on where you're located, and then again from 4 to 7 p.m. Pacific. So once again, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Pacific, and then we're going to take a little break and come back and do another three-hour stint, maybe longer, starting at 4 o'clock Pacific time. I invite you to join in. We're going to ask people to call in, to join our telethon, to rally your friends, to share their emails with us so that we can get in touch with them, and to help start raising money for this important effort. It's a big lift. Yes, we have a very ambitious plan, but with your support, we can make it happen and help change the media in 2016 with NewsBud. Well, I played the Beverly Hillbillies theme because there are actually some oil drilling wells in Beverly Hills and all across Southern California. Many people who haven't been there don't know that. But my congressman, Jared Huffman, a Democrat from here in San Rafael, has introduced legislation in the House called the Keep It in the Ground Act of 2016. And it is the companion legislation to a bill with the same name introduced in the Senate by one Senator Bernie Sanders. This, of course, has the backing of Bill McKibben and 350.org, the Sierra Club, and many other organizations. And I give credit to my congressman, Jared Huffman. He's running for his third term this year, largely unopposed. He's got a very safe seat. But despite the fact that he's in the minority, he's not just sitting back and, you know, naming post offices and writing meaningless resolutions. So I give Jared Huffman credit for sponsoring this legislation. And with Sanders' support in the Senate, you may want to know that Hillary Clinton has a nuanced position. She says she wants to ban future development of oil and gas resources on public lands, and the Keep It in the Ground Act would ban not only future contracts, but it would cancel existing ones. So this is a very important element of addressing climate change that we really need to move forward on. And I'm glad to see that Jared Huffman is sponsoring this legislation. Now, we recently interviewed the congressman for the local cable television show that I co-host with Larry Strick. It's called Marin Voices and Views. And I want to play a clip from my conversation with Congressman Huffman, where we talked about the way the transportation bill relied on funding generated from selling oil from America's strategic reserves. As you'll see, I don't think much of that idea.
Jared, both houses finally stopped the dance of these short-term extensions of the transportation bill. But Republicans absolutely refuse to raise the gasoline tax, which we know hasn't been raised for 20 years, and it's pegged to the gallon instead of the dollar, and therefore we don't have enough money to fix our freeways and bridges. And I'm really glad that the transportation bill was passed. But one of the funding mechanisms is to sell oil from these strategic reserves. Now, we've got an oil glut worldwide, mm-hmm. prices at an all-time low. This is as smart as getting a payday loan.
Yeah, buy high, sell low is apparently the strategy.
Yeah.
Whose idea was it? Can we
this
get
is a Republican name? Idea, so let's be very clear about
but
that.
But is there a spear chucker who we can identify as the idiot who proposed this?
It's more like this. You sort of back into funding solutions like that because Republicans have taken everything else off the table. So, raise the gas tax, put in a vehicle miles traveled fee, do repatriation of overseas revenue from American companies. All of these could have provided, legitimate, honest funding solutions for the transportation bill. All of them were taken off the table by our Republican colleagues. And so you're left with gimmicks. And you're right, there's nothing more gimmicky than selling a strategic asset like the Strategic Petroleum Reserve at $30 a barrel oil prices. That's pretty foolish.
It's ridiculous, actually.
Yeah.
So that's Jared Huffman, and as I mentioned, he has introduced the Keep It in the Ground Act in the House of Representatives. Well, they're keeping it in the ground in Southern California at the Porter Ranch site, where gas has been leaking on a massive scale since October 23rd. And Southern California Gas they drilled a separate well or a different tap to it, and they believe that they have begun the process of sealing the well and permanently stopping the leak. That's good news, and I'm happy to report that to you. We have 1,100 miles of coastline here in California, and when Jerry Brown was a younger Governor Moonbeam, he signed the Coastal Act, which created a coastal commission. And if you want to build or develop anything along the coast, you have to get approval from the Coastal Commission. And it's not easy. Ask The Edge, the guitarist from U2. He took, 4 to 5 years to win approval for a scaled-back plan to build 5 homes on the pristine hills of Malibu. And it is the restrictions on development that many enviros believe led to the commission's decision to fire its executive director. In a meeting Wednesday in San Luis Obispo, the commission voted 7-5 to sack Charles Lester, who has been the executive director for about 4.5 years. And some commissioners feel that they have been maligned. They said, look, this was a personnel matter, and that the campaign to save his job by supporters of Charles Lester had unfairly portrayed them as being pawns of developers. Well, after being sacked, Lester gave a kind of mild-mannered comment. He said, relative to commissions of the past, this commission has been more interested in things that the development community raises as problems, as opposed to the policies of the Coastal Act. And not all of the members of the commission were on board. Governor Jerry Brown could have stepped in and told people he didn't want Lester fired. He didn't do that. So it's clear that the commissioners were doing something that he at least passively accepted, if not directed from behind the scenes. But the head of the state assembly, the speaker, Tony Atkins from San Diego, said, let me apologize to the public. I truly thought my appointees would be better stewards of the coast. And billionaire Tom Steyer, who is very active in political campaigns, promoting efforts to address climate change, he said, behind closed doors, the Coastal Commission defied the will of the people and acted to weaken the protection of California's iconic beaches. This is a wake-up call for all who care about preserving California's majestic coastline for future generations. And while we're hanging out on the sunny coast of California, it's going to be 70 degrees this weekend here, the ban on crabbing has been lifted. We are told that the chemical that warmer temperatures was producing, a neurotoxin in these crabs, has dropped to undetectable levels, and the crustaceans are now safe to eat. You can expect I'll be having crab sometime this weekend. In Syria, there is an announcement from Munich of an agreement between the U.S. and Russia for a pause in the fighting. John Kerry, negotiating with Lavrov, his Russian counterpart, announced this pause and acknowledged that it's not necessarily a ceasefire. They're hoping to be able to resupply some people who are trapped in towns and cities that are under siege in Syria right now. But this doesn't appear to have much traction. The death toll it's announced now in the Syrian civil war as it moves into its sixth year is closing in on 500,000. The official estimate now is 470,000. And with Russia running as many as 500 airstrikes a day in support of the Assad government in Damascus, the situation is shifting dramatically. This has forced, with the assault on Aleppo, new pressure at the Turkish border, the northern part of Syria, southern part of Turkey. And the Turks don't want to open their gates, their borders, to more refugees. But it's been a very porous border where we know the Islamic State has been able to move oil out of Syria and somehow get it to the international market. So this is a very complicated situation. There appears to be very little buy-in on the ground from those actually doing the fighting. The New York Times located Youssef Faru, a fighter whose group receives ammunition and salaries from the United States. They are members of Safwa al-Islamiyya. And this is just one of some 41 groups of different rebel fighters that are supported as proxies by outsiders like the United States. I don't believe we support all 41, but I don't really know. And of course, our media, our elected leaders, our president don't tell us any of this stuff, so we are left to speculate. Anyway, Youssef Faru says skeptically, Russia will continue bombing Nusra and Daesh. He said, if we thought Russia was bombing Nusra clearly and specifically, we would have moved away from them. So he's saying, look, they're only going after the people who are directly opposed to the Assad government. And this, of course, causes the whole situation to break down and allow the fighting and the carnage to continue, perhaps indefinitely. Well, we've been covering with great interest the legal actions by Vice News and our friend Jason Leopold, through his lawyer Ryan James, to force the State Department to disgorge the rest of Hillary Clinton's emails. And yesterday in Washington, Judge Rudolph Contreras ruled in favor of Vice News and was very critical of the State Department. He said that there's a compelling public interest in Clinton's emails. He ordered State to explain reasons for the delay and said that they must release all of them before the South Carolina primary on February 29th. Well, the State Department said that's impossible. And then they said, well, maybe we can release some of them. So Contreras ordered the State Department to release 550 emails on February 13th, that's tomorrow, and the rest in two batches, one on February 19th and the other on February 26th. And this is a victory for transparency, for the Freedom of Information Act, a personal victory for Jason Leopold. And as I have been telling you, the content of these emails is significant. Not all of them, but there are some that are deeply troubling. And the Wall Street Journal reported yesterday that last fall, and I don't know why there's been a delay in disclosing this, but last fall, investigators with the State Department subpoenaed the Bill Hillary and Chelsea Clinton Foundation seeking documents about the charity's projects that may have required approval from the federal government while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. The subpoena also asked for records related to Hillary's top confidant, Huma Abedin, and her unusual employment arrangement where for a six-month period in 2012, she was permitted to work for the State Department, for the Clinton Foundation, for Hillary's personal office, and for a private consulting firm with ties to the Clintons. So these are just some of the issues, as I've told you, what has surfaced in what Sidney Blumenthal did, trading information for favors with Secretary of State Clinton, lobbying for Joe Wilson to get a $60 million-plus grant from a fund controlled by the Secretary of State. And we have seen recent reporting from David Sirota at the International Business Times of how companies and governments that benefited from arms sales approved by Secretary of State Clinton gave heavily to the Clinton Foundation. Now, this has not really surfaced, and Bernie Sanders has been way too polite about it in the debates. There was another one in Milwaukee last night, hosted by PBS and moderated by Gwen Ifill and Judy Woodruff. And it was okay, I'll say that. I don't think the moderators did the greatest job, but I think both candidates performed very well. And while you know I'm not a supporter of Hillary Clinton, I give her her due. She is a very effective debater. She thinks fast on her feet. She can summon the memorized information about Bernie Sanders' voting record, and she does it all very well. Last night, Sanders was back on his game, particularly during the second hour when they focused on foreign policy. And I was so relieved and pleased to see it because, you know, in the last debate a week ago, I said that Hillary had successfully exploited Bernie's biggest weakness, foreign policy. And I think that he performed at a B-plus level, even an A-minus level last night, in particular when he pushed back on who will advise him and simply excluded Henry Kissinger. And then ripped Hillary upside for her cozy relationship with Dr. Kissinger. It also was interesting to see as Sanders widened his critique beyond the Clinton vote in favor of invading Iraq in 2002 to include the broader topics of regime change. He actually mentioned Libya and inferred that her advocacy for the overthrow of Gaddafi was a big mistake. He flubbed a question about which departments he would cut the budgets for. I screamed at the TV, "The Pentagon, Bernie, the Pentagon!" And he did circle back to it in a follow-up answer, but it should have been his first call. Now, one of the low points of this debate was when Hillary Clinton pivoted from a question, a softball about, you know, who are the leaders that you respect. She said, well, Nelson Mandela. And then she hammered Sanders on a completely different front, saying that he had expressed disagreements with Barack Obama and that somehow that's a problem. And she, you know, Sanders did a blurb for Bill Press's recent book, which I don't know the exact title, but it suggests that Obama disappointed or let down progressives. Well, you know I feel that way a lot more than Bill Press does. So Sanders did effectively respond to that attack from Hillary. But she said, you know, the comments that he had made about Obama, he said, the kind of criticism we've heard from Senator Sanders about our president, I expect from Republicans. I do not expect from someone running for the Democratic nomination. Now, Sanders has been, I think, very clever in walking a tightrope. He doesn't want to be like Al Gore and keep his predecessor of the same party at arm's length. At the same time, he knows that his agenda shows the weakness of Obama on criminal justice reform, on race relations, on the rights of women. And so I think that Sanders was pretty good in responding to that attack from Senator Clinton, who continues to offer, you know, that she's the pragmatic adult in the room. Here's this guy who's, what, 5 years older than her and looks 10 years older. And she tries to play the grown-up, saying, well, you know, you can't have tuition-free universities and colleges. You just can't. And her half-a-loaf approach, her incremental approach, I think is a big mistake in this year of the outsider, this year of the anti-establishment mentality in both parties. And so as Hillary tries to rein in what she considers to be the pie in the sky offered by Bernie Sanders, she does a lot of damage to her own potential, should she win the nomination, to unite Sanders supporters behind her. And so I think that in, you know, on balance and when you get to the bottom line, that Hillary took some steps to attack Sanders last night that may help her short term, but certainly won't help her long term. This next item is something that is extremely painful for me. I have met John Lewis. I've interviewed him several times. I was the MC of an event where he came to California and recounted his work as a civil rights leader in the South during the era of Dr. King. And he was, of course, a leader in the civil rights movement of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. It was called SNCC. And when Lewis came to California, it was for a forgiveness meeting where he publicly forgave a white man who had beaten him in a protest, I think it was in South Carolina. So I have the deepest respect for John Lewis. And so it was really troubling when I read his comments yesterday about Bernie Sanders and the protests in the 1960s. Quote, I never saw him. I never met him. I was chair of SNCC for 3 years from 63 to 66, involved in the sit-ins, the Freedom Ride, the March on Washington, the March from Selma to Montgomery. I directed the Voter Education Project for 6 years. But I met Hillary Clinton. I met President Clinton. Now, hold on a minute. And again, it's a very uncomfortable position here to see an iconic civil rights leader being used to swift boat Bernie Sanders. This was the way the Republicans took on John Kerry. They got other veterans to say, John Kerry's not telling the truth about Vietnam. And here's John Lewis saying Bernie Sanders isn't telling the truth about Selma, about the marches that he participated in with Dr. King. And fortunately for Sanders, there are photographs that show it. There's one that I saw on Facebook today where John Lewis is standing next to Dr. King in the front line of a protest march. And Bernie Sanders is clearly visible 3 rows back and you know, 4 rows over. Now, it's possible that Lewis didn't meet Sanders. There were a lot of people there. But this is a calculated attack. The other piece that regrettably undermines Lewis's statements yesterday is his own book from a couple of years ago, where he says he first met Bill Clinton maybe in the mid-'80s, but for sure in the early 90s. So this effort to use John Lewis to divide Democratic voters as the Democratic primary heads to the southern states with a lot of African Americans voting, this is really, really divisive and painful to see. And if the Clintons pull this out long term, this may be a blip that we don't think about. But we saw Bill Clinton in 2008 used racist themes against Barack Obama in the South Carolina primary. And this appears to be a new way of achieving a similar goal. One of the other hits on Bernie Sanders, and I've said it myself, is that he doesn't distinguish himself on foreign policy. And he didn't really answer the question when it was posed again about who his foreign policy advisors are. But one guy that he has met with is a man who I've known for over 10 years, Lawrence Korb, who gave advice on foreign policy to Ronald Reagan back in the 1980s. He served in the Pentagon. I think he was Undersecretary of the Navy or something like that. And Larry Korb moved to the left when George W. Bush entered the White House. He has been a longtime fellow at the Center for American Progress. I've interviewed Larry Korb more than a dozen times. I have great respect for him. One interview, he was on his cell phone in his car and had to ring off because he got into an accident while we were talking. But I'm linking to a post, an article that Lawrence Korb put up at Politico yesterday. And he says, yes, I did meet with Senator Sanders once. I'm not on his campaign, and people keep asking me, is he serious about foreign policy? And he says, I think he is. In my dealings with him, analyzing his record in Congress over the past 25 years, I have found that Sanders has taken balanced, realistic positions on many of the most critical foreign policy issues facing this country. In fact, given his long tenure in the House and Senate, he has more foreign policy experience than Ronald Reagan or Barack Obama did when they were running for office the first time. What would a President Sanders foreign policy look like? Well, he says, I believe it would be rooted in a number of key principles. First, restraint in using American force abroad. Korb also argues that he would, let's see, he goes back to 2006 here, saying that I briefed him when we discussed a foreign policy paper I had co-authored about how the U.S. could begin a strategic phased withdrawal from Iraq. Unlike many of his Democratic colleagues who characterized our plan as cut and run, Sanders supported it. He said his military restraint extends to spending as well. He has demonstrated an admirable commitment to diplomacy. That as president, he would govern more like Dwight Eisenhower, who refused to give in to the demands of the military-industrial complex, or like Nixon, who cut defense spending dramatically and developed a healthcare plan more inclusive than Obamacare. So I think that this is a very important endorsement coming from Lawrence Korb, a respected leader on military and foreign policy issues. And his final paragraph here is, I have no doubt that Sanders will be willing to challenge the foreign policy establishment, as Obama did on some issues. Does Sanders have the same amount of foreign policy experience as Hillary Clinton? Obviously not. But Bill Clinton had far less foreign policy experience than George H.W. Bush, and Obama had less than John McCain. And both have had effective foreign policies. Well, I disagree with a lot of the foreign policy positions of Barack Obama, but you already know that. Every day I like to pause for a minute and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. There are people like Benny Alto in Oregon, Cheryl Fleming, Faith Peoples, and Terry Paris. They're all monthly subscribers, and I really appreciate their ongoing support. And I want to invite you to join in. I've got a new bonus gift for anybody who takes out a new annual subscription and lives in the continental U.S. The reason for that restriction is I have a hard copy of the book, and it's too complicated and expensive to ship things out of the country. But if you take out a new $50 subscription right here, right now, I'm going to reward you with a copy of Ben Parker's fun book, A Field Guide to the F Word. Yes, you can become an expert on the most powerful word in the English language. Just four little powerful letters. And I'd love to send it along to you if you take out a new annual subscription. Come over to peterbcollins.com. You click the menu link, then you click Become a Subscriber, and our options include $5, $10, $20 a month, the $50 annual subscription. You can make a one-time contribution of any amount using PayPal, or you can mail it into the P.O. box that appears on that page. The New York Times is reporting on disclosures by the New York American Civil Liberties Union office that the Stingray cell phone tracking systems that we have exposed on this program now for several years have been used on more than 1,000 occasions since 2008. And if you are one of those people who's kind of wobbly about the Fourth Amendment, you might say, well, yeah, but they only used it on terrorism investigations, right? Well, no. In the course of investigating rapes, murders, crimes, and searches for missing people. And routinely, they do not get a court order in New York. They operate under an ancient law called a pen register law that allowed for the tapping of old wireline telephones, landlines. Well, this puts the law enforcement agencies into a very uncomfortable area because many of them don't notify the court that they're using this dragnet device, and it sweeps up all of the cell phone information of every phone within its radius. And in New York, they say even though it's capable of allowing them to listen to phone calls, they say, trust us, we do not intercept contents of any communications. No, they just want location and the identifying information, right? Yeah, right. So it'll be interesting to see if these increasing disclosures of Stingray raise the kind of attention I'd like to see. As you know, I thought it should have come up in the debate in Milwaukee last night, and once again, it wasn't raised. And Ron Wyden of Oregon and Congressman Jason Chaffetz of Utah, Democrat and Republican respectively, have introduced the GPS Act, which would extend the Department of Justice's guidelines to all law enforcement agencies. But we need more explicit legislation than that. Stingrays should be explicitly outlawed, except in cases where a court order is acquired. Yesterday, I reported the disgusting news from Cleveland that the city had billed the family of Tamir Rice $500 for the ambulance ride that he took to the hospital where he was declared dead after being shot by a cop seconds after the cop rolled up and found Tamir playing in a little park with a toy gun. Well, the mayor of Cleveland, Frank G. Jackson, has apologized to the family and withdrawn the invoice for the $500 with obviously great embarrassment. And from what I know, I don't follow the news in Cleveland on a daily basis, but this mayor has really avoided getting involved in the whole scandal over the police department, the failure to prosecute the officer, the grand jury's decision not to do so, and also district attorney's decisions to decline to prosecute. And I just am incensed that this even happened. Yesterday, we're all relieved, I think, and I have many listeners in Oregon, that the last occupier left the Malheur Refuge outside of Burns, Oregon. He was 27-year-old David Fry of Ohio, and according to the New York Times, he asked for pizza and marijuana. He criticized a government that condones abortion and drone strikes. He talked about UFOs and his risk of dying. And then apparently he said one more cookie, one more cigarette, and came out of his hideout, demanding that all of the law enforcement agents who are on the scene there wave to him. And apparently some of them did. So I'm glad that there was no further loss of life. I am scheduled to talk with Todd McFarlane, the attorney who we interviewed a week ago, who represents the family of Lavoy Finicum, the one individual who was killed as a result of the standoff at the wildlife refuge there. And we'll bring you more information on that in that interview next week. And finally today, I'm delighted to share with you a profile of one of my all-time favorite soul singers in America. Her name is Mavis Staples. And I met Mavis through her dad, Pop Staples. He was a listener to my all-night radio show in Chicago back in the mid-1970s. And he invited me down to the family's club. Let's do it. At 110th and Stony Island on the south side of Chicago one night, where I got to meet Mavis, Cleo, and all the rest of the family. Pops is gone, but Mavis sings on. She has one of the most beautiful voices of any human being I've ever heard. As rich and soulful as you can imagine. And the interesting thing in this story in The Guardian, a story I'd never heard about, is that Bob Dylan so admired her voice that one time he proposed matrimony to Mavis Staples. Mavis says, "I often think about what would have happened if I'd married Bobby, if we'd had some little plum crushers, how our lives would be. The kids would be singing now, and Bobby and I would be holding each other up." Aunt Mavis also tells a story about David Bowie, who showed up backstage at a Prince concert where Mavis was opening, and he walked into her dressing room and said, "There she is, that beautiful lady." And she said, "You know, I just never thought David Bowie would be excited to meet me. You just don't think that certain people know you, you know?" She said, "I didn't sleep that night." I'm going to let this song roll all the way through. It's the Staple Singers with Pop and Mavis called Let's Do It Again. I'm Peter B. Collins. Thanks for listening today.
Sweet face, or laid up next to mine, sweet love in the